Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Rates and Lanes with Rico Mohammed. This is the show where we improve your knowledge of the freight market, improve your bottom line, and improve the transportation industry as a whole. We're talking Rates and Lanes. Let's move on down the audio road.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Rates and Lanes podcast. I am your host, Rico Mohammed. We have our special guest making his monthly appearance with us tonight, Mr. Hank Seaton. So don't be bashful, ladies and gentlemen. If you have a question about any type of contract, whether you got a question about your lease purchase, any type of transportation contract at all, tonight is the night to definitely try to get in to ask your question. We will be trying to be as caller heavy as possible. We want to try to take as many calls as we possibly can within this 1 hour that we have. We want to try to get you in. So if you got a question or anything like that, go ahead and press number one now. One of my lovely daughters is down ready to screen your call and get you guys logged in and ready to come up and on board with us. With that said, without any further ado, we're going to try to get through the beginning portion of the show as we normally do. We start out with the USDA truck rate report for this week. And according to the report this week, we don't have any areas with any shortages. Got a couple of areas with slight shortages, and those are South Florida and Mexico crossing through Texas. Areas that are showing slight surpluses that you might want to avoid: Central and Western Arizona, Mexico crossing through Nogales, Arizona, Imperial and Coachella Valley, California, Kern District, California, Oxnard District, California, Salinas, Watsonville, California, Santa Maria, California, Minnesota, North Dakota, Red River Valley, and Columbia Basin, Washington. Areas that have outright surpluses that you might want to make sure that you are getting a hefty, taking a hefty backhaul with you to help you out when you're trying to come out of there. If you're working that spot market, San Luis Valley, Colorado, in Nebraska, both of those are showing outright surpluses. If you would like a more in-depth look at this report, you can go right over to the Rates and Lanes Facebook page with Rico Mohammed and click on the link there, and it'll take you directly to this report where you can go and dig deeper into it for you at a later time at your convenience. Jumping right on over into the DAT trend lines report for this week, load-to-truck ratios increased for reefers and flatbeds last week, with flatbeds continuing a six-week climb. However, that did not translate into rate increases. Last week, the national average van rate dropped by 3 cents per mile, while both reefer rates and flatbed rates slipped by 1 cent per mile. So let's take a deeper look into these reports real quickly, jumping over into the U.S. van and demand capacity report for the week of March 5th through the 11th. Van load postings declined by 2.5% last week, while truck postings held steady. That caused the load-to-truck ratio to dip 2%, down from 2.9 to 2.8 loads per truck. The national average van rate, as I previously stated, fell by 3 cents per mile last week on the spot market. Let's take a deeper dive and look into the rates for those drive-ins. After increasing 4 cents per mile the previous week, last week van rates retreated 3 cents per mile. The national average rate for vans fell to $1.63 per mile. Outbound load volumes and rates increased in Houston and Charlotte, but fell in Los Angeles. Taking a look by region on the spot market for dry vans, starting out in the northeastern portion of the United States, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania being our representative city, showing average spot market rates for dry vans at $1.56 per mile. Moving down into the southeastern portion of the United States, Atlanta, Georgia checks in, showing spot market rates for dry vans at $1.88 per mile. Moving into the Midwest, we have Chicago, Illinois checking in, showing spot market rates at $1.90 per mile. And moving into the south central portion of the United States, Dallas, Texas being the representative city, spot market rate showing at $1.52 per mile. And moving out west on the West Coast, average spot market rates for dry vans on the spot market out of Los Angeles, $1.82 per mile. And just to mention, diesel fuel prices dropped by 0.8% over the last week to a national average of $2.56 per gallon. Moving right along, jumping over into the U.S. flatbed demand and capacity report for the week of March 5th through the 11th, the flatbed load-to-truck ratio increased for the sixth week in a row. Last week, flatbed load postings increased 4%, while truck postings held steady. That caused the load-to-truck ratio to increase by 4% up to 35.8 loads per truck nationally. Last week, the national average flatbed rate declined by 1 cent per mile. Let's take a look and a deeper look at the U.S. flatbed rates on the spot market. Despite an increase in the load-to-truck ratio last week, the national average flatbed rate slipped by 1 cent per mile to $2.01 per mile. Taking a look around the country, starting out in the northeastern portion of the United States, Harrisburg, PA checks in, showing average spot market rates for flatbeds at $3.07 per mile. Moving down into the southeastern portion of the United States, Atlanta, Georgia checks in, showing average spot market rate for flatbeds at $2.35 per mile. Moving up into the Midwest, Rock Island, Illinois checking in, spot market rates for flatbeds at $2.54 per mile. Moving down into the south central portion of the United States, Houston is the representative city, showing $2.10 per mile on average for the spot market. And moving out west, Phoenix, Arizona, rounding out the report, coming in at a paltry $1.60 per mile on the spot market for flatbeds. Let's jump over here into the reefer demand segment of the report really quickly. Last week, reefer load postings held steady while truck postings declined by 1%. That caused the load-to-truck ratio to inch up 1% to 5.8 loads per truck. The national average spot market rate for reefers dipped by 1 cent per mile last week. Let's take a look at those rates for the week of March 5th through the 11th for reefers. Reefer rates dipped 1 cent per mile nationally to an average of $1.87 per mile, with prices rising in the Texas and Los Angeles markets. Starting out in the northeastern portion of the United States, we're showing average spot market rates out of Elizabeth, New Jersey at $1.70 per mile. Moving down into the southeastern portion of the United States, Lakeland, Florida checking in, showing average reefer spot market rates at $1.36 per mile. Moving up into Green Bay, Wisconsin, we have $2.63 per mile on average. Moving down into the south central portion of the United States, we have $2.08 per mile coming out of McAllen, Texas. And moving out west, wrapping up the report, coming out of Fresno, California, $1.81 per mile on average for the spot market for reefers out of the West Coast. And really quickly, before we jump into bringing our guest on, we are going to wrap up this week's Bad Broker Report. Not as many jump names have been added to this list, but it's still quite significant all the same. This week, starting out on the report, Pro Alliance Network, Inc., MC number 995803. FMCSA shows trust fund is set to cancel on 3/22/17. Over $46,000 in reported non-payment complaints have been reported. There have been notices that this broker also has nearly $1 million in unpaid carrier invoices. They are considered to be an extreme risk. Again, that MC number is 995803. The next one on the list is American Optimized Logistics Solutions Group, Inc. MC number is 578607. Over $2,000 in non-payment complaints have been reported. International Logistics Management, Inc., MC number is 712067. FMCSA shows that surety bond is set to cancel on 3/30/17. Over $6,000 in nonpayment complaints have been reported. XL Freight Logistics LLC, MC number is 951-344. Over $6,000 in nonpayment complaints have been reported. This one is a shocker. Grable Forwarders, Inc., Grable Van Life LLC, MC number 184224. This broker has over $85,000 in unpaid carrier invoices. That is a shocker right there. Grable Forwarders, Inc., MC number 184224. Grable has kind of been a staple in the moving industry. Kind of shocked to see their name make that report. The last one on the list, Recycling Revolution LLC. This is a shipper. Recycling Revolution LLC has received information that this shipper has over $7,000 in unpaid carrier invoices. So once again, ladies and gentlemen, we got Hank Seaton on with us tonight. So if you're having any of these issues, one thing that I would definitely advise you to do is make sure that you got Hank's book, Rules of the Road. If you are a listener of the show, you can use a promotional code to get a discount. RICO, the promotional code is RICO2016. Type that in when you're checking out, and you can get that discount on the book, and it'll help you avoid some of these pitfalls. And with that said, no further ado, let's bring the man of the hour on, our esteemed guest making his monthly stop, Mr. Hank Seaton. Hank, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Rico. How are you?
I'm doing very well, very well. Kind of excited to talk to you tonight and to see what our listeners may bring to the table with us tonight. Another issue that I want to bring up really quickly before we jump into it, my email box has been getting inundated by a lot of people that I have done business with wanting to know, sending out surveys, wanting to know what type of solution are we providing for this new, what we have been talking about here on the show for a couple of weeks now, the solution that you guys have to offer for the food safety program
that they have. It's the Food Safety Modernization Act, yes.
Right,
Rico,
right.
I would cherish if you've kept them, sending me a list of the people who are inquiring about it so that we can reach out and maybe provide them with some information.
Absolutely. I'll see if I can get that list over to you before the night's over with. I'll just go back in my email box and I'll shoot you an email on that.
Okay. Let me give you and listeners a little background on what is actually happening. April is the compliance date for large carriers with over 27.5 million are supposed to have in place, I think it's April 7th, a food safety materials training program. So a lot of the large carriers are scrambling trying to make that date. Also, a good number of friends and clients went to the Food Shippers Association convention, which is a great big convention that was held last week, and it was really the buzz down there with primarily shippers and brokers trying to inquire about what are the carriers doing to be FSMA compliant. And what is happening is the shippers are enforcing on the brokers and on down to the small carriers as anticipated that we want to know that you're going to train your drivers in food safety awareness. We're going to want to know that your drivers are going, or your truckers are going to have compliant reefers, that you understand what the cleanliness is about, all of the 16 requirements of FSMA, most of which are just delegable requirements from the shipper down to the carrier. And so all of a sudden we're getting a rush of carriers, both large and small, joining the protocol. Now, the purpose, again, of the protocol is just to allow carriers large and small to say that they will require with these rudimentary requirements of FSMA, and that they will also provide us with a certificate of insurance. Some major brokers and carriers are endorsing the protocol, so the numbers of small carriers is really beginning to climb just in the past couple of weeks of people joining the protocol. And I think, Rico, you can probably share the content of what some of these requests are. The ones that I have seen may recommend the protocol. They certainly want to know what you're doing to get FSMA compliant. And I think in the next 3 weeks this is really going to hit. I've got an announcement I can make about the hazardous material training program and its availability. We found something there that I think will mesh well with what we currently have with the protocol. But hopefully industry can all move in that direction so that we can have one minimum standard rather than a small carrier having to do one thing for one shipper and one thing for another.
Absolutely, and that's pretty much, you hit the nail on the head. They're inquiring as to what type of what are we doing to be prepared for the upcoming mandate with the from the USDA. I'm sorry, not the U.S. It's the food. It's the, actually, this is coming from the FDA. Is that correct, Hank?
Yeah, it's coming from the FDA.
I just wanted to make sure which we had the right alphabet soup on now. and is
yeah,
there
now,
anything else? I see we got a caller with a question. We're coming to you in just a second, caller. Just want to try and do a quick little housekeeping. So just be patient with us. But is there anything else new coming down the pipe that we need to be made aware of, Hank?
Well, yeah, before we get off this topic, anybody on the line might want to take down the initials UFSTP.com. That stands for Uniform Food Safety Transportation Protocol, UFSTP.
I got the link up on the Rates and Lanes Facebook page already. I just put it up.
Good.
Well,
they can find out a little bit about
anybody interested.
Yeah, about the protocol. The other thing is there's several training programs out here, and I don't mean to be disparaging about any of them, but one that's going to be available in the next on the 20th that we've looked into is one that is sponsored by the University of Tennessee, which has a agricultural extension program that's worked with the FDA in preparing training organization training programs for FDA. Their program for truck drivers will be available on a dial-up basis and will result in you getting a certificate of completion that will be sent not only to the carrier but also to the driver. So that will be portable. In other words, once you have been trained by the University of Tennessee, if you go from one carrier to another, you can show and document your training. We looked at the program. We had it screened by three major carriers, and everybody seems to be happy that it meets the requirement of the Act. The fact that it's not some oddball training program and has been vetted in a way by FDA, I think, makes it a very attractive program. It should take a driver something less than an hour to read it. There are some questions. You can do it at your own space. It's I think it's a good program. So if you're getting pressure, from your shipper to go ahead and get that training that will be available.
All right, Hank. Well, we definitely appreciate the heads up on that. Let's go ahead and try to mix in a couple of callers. Caller, I forgot to put the name up. So, caller, we don't have your name, but you're calling from area code 301. What's your name and how can we help?
This is Mike. Thanks for taking my call, Rico and Mr. Seaton. I have a quick question. Maybe not so quick. I'm trying to avoid what I think is a pitfall. A friend of mine has his own authority, and until a couple months ago, he got into a family situation which required him to move out of country. It took him longer than he anticipated, so his insurance lapsed, and his authority was revoked. Came back a couple weeks back, put everything back, now he's operating. I got my own authority, but he's running into a situation where many brokers are saying that his authority is too new, and therefore they won't book loads for him. And so he's been requesting me to book loads under my authority in instances where he's having trouble getting out of certain areas. And he's saying that all I need is to have my company as a loss payee on his insurance, and if anything happens, I should be protected. Is it that really that simple, or I should be thinking about something else more comprehensive if I need to help him?
I don't think it's all that simple. There are one of two ways that someone else can run for you or under your authority. One way would be if you were a broker and you were brokering it to him, and whoever had signed you up as a broker, and you were responsible for hiring him. That doesn't work because that's not what you're doing. The other way would be for you to set him up under a lease agreement. If you set him up under a lease agreement, you would have to be responsible for his safe operations. You'd have to have a driver file. You'd have to have everything for him in the spot market that you otherwise have to have if you were leasing on an owner-operator. And just being named as an additional insured on his policy wouldn't really satisfy me, because whoever is insuring your truck or your company is probably insuring your vehicle. And if you had to put this guy's logo on your door, he could have to pick up the lawsuit. So you really can't hire a guy as an independent contractor. Just name him as an additional insured and not report it to your insurance company. That's just too much. There's just too much issue there. Let me ask you, caller, a question.
Sure.
Even though he went out of the country, when he came back and reinstated his insurance, he should have gotten his original docket number back. So, you know, if he'd been around for 2 years, anybody that would look up his docket number would see the older docket number. How long was he in business before he left the country and came back?
4 years.
Well, I don't understand. You can go on FMCSA.org and see if he's got an old docket number or not. Unless he filed for new authority, I can't see why the system would show him as a virgin and not just to reinstate an old docket number. Because in fact, a lot of people who have been out of business for up to a year or two will come back and go through a reinstatement rather than file for new authority for that very reason that you mentioned.
That is correct. He's not getting new authority. He's keeping all his DOT numbers and his operating authority number. Everything is just the same. He's being just reinstated because it's not even been a couple months.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he shouldn't have any more problem now than when he left the country, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, I guess it depends on some of these brokers, what they see and what they consider. So I'm not sure what's going on. I mean, I'm not running into that problem, but that's what he tells me. that he's being refused loads because of that reinstatement that he, you know, so I also don't understand.
Well,
this,
if I were going to go into it, I would be saying, hey, look, you need to be an owner-operator for me, and for the liability purposes, I'm going to take a typical commission, which, you know, is not going to be financially advantageous to him if he's got his own authority and set up to run his own.
Okay. Appreciate your time, sir. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Rico.
Yes, sir. Quick, just to horse back off that a little bit there, Hank. With the new, when they brought in the new law, it kind of messed it up for you can't really do interlining anymore from one carrier to another.
That is true unless you haul the load a portion of the way. I'll give you an example. I'm working on a case right now where a collection agency is trying to go against a shipper claiming that the carrier wasn't paid. But in fact, the underlying carrier the collection agency represents didn't pick up the shipment. It was an interline shipment that was taken to Chicago by a carrier and given to the delivering carrier. Now, that still classifies as an interline because the origin carrier, the one the shipper paid, handled the load a portion of the way. The analysis in terms of the delivering carrier's recourse is, I think, entirely different from a double brokered situation because the delivering carrier took the freight from the origin carrier who agreed to pay it. The delivering carrier is not named on the bill of lading, wasn't in possession of the shipment under the bill, and in that case, your analysis, I think, for liability changes a good bit. But one of the real take-homes for anybody on the phone, on the line, again, is remember this. If you take a load off of a call board from ABC and your driver goes in to pick up the shipment and XYZ shows up as the carrier of record, you got a problem. You got a problem.
Make that sure that you get your name on that bill of lading.
Get your name on the bill, but, you know, just because you see Swift or Werner on the bill, don't feel that putting your name on it is going to do anything else other than set you up for a lawsuit, because very clearly the guy you got the load from isn't the one the shipper hauled, the shipper hired.
Right. Okay, well, with that said, we got a couple more people with some questions, so let's go. Got to get my call screen to put the names up here, but we got someone who wants to talk about the food safety calling from 402 area code. Caller, you up live with Rico and Hank. How can we help?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. We haul dog food, okay, canned dog food in dry vans, and it'd be a good thing for us to have that permit as well. Is that correct?
Well, actually, I think that fresh dog food or dog food in a bag is probably FSMA sensitive. I think canned dog food, because it's shelf ready and not subject to temperature variance, is probably not technically subject to FSMA. There are exclusions, and it's they're a little bit ill-defined because FDA hasn't come out with the specificity you would expect. But clearly, canned dog food is shelf-ready. And so I'm not – if that was all you were transporting, I would be careful before I figured out that I was need to be FSMA compliant.
Does it cost something to get the educational or the class and the permit or whatever you need? Would it be a good idea for me to get that?
I think because the act itself says that it applies to human and animal food, I don't think the training, the $50 it cost, nor being aware of it, you know, if you don't have – Obviously, if you don't have a reefer and you've just got a dry van, your analysis may be a bit different. But what I think is going to happen is I think these FSMA rules are going to set the standard regardless of whether or not the shipment is technically within the four square of FSMA. Because all that's really basically required is trailer cleanliness, an operating reefer, ability to download the records, your agreement to comply with special conditions set forth in writing by the shipper. It's not a real hard hill to climb.
Okay. I'm kind of thinking it'd probably be in my best interest to really have the permit in my back pocket just for giggles.
Yeah, it actually what it is it's not like a hazardous permit. The one thing that the UT program will give you is it will give you a certificate. So, you know, if you get to a dock and somebody says, prove to me you've had safety awareness or sanity or food awareness, you'll have a certificate to present. I don't know whether shippers are going to get that that extreme. I think it's very likely that if Rico were to show up and wasn't a household name to every shipper in the country, they might say, "Hey, you know, are you aware of these food safety rules?" And, you know, the carrier's answer is going to be, yeah, you know, you can look on the side of the door and go on the protocol and see that everybody is trained and we got insurance. If you're, you know, hauling produce or for some reason you're a onesie, I think they might actually ask you at some point to prove you're in compliance. And, you know, the protocol accomplishes that, and clearly this training certificate would be, you know, one thing to show that you were aware of how to handle a product that could be adulterated. The term adulterated or contaminated is really, you know, at the basis of this. Is the product perishable? There are provisions that say, you know, you could contaminate a shipment if you had, you know, certain commodities both on the truck at the same time. So the FSMA training would alert you to that.
Okay. Can we find your Facebook page or how to get the training, the course and all that?
If you go to the Rates and Lanes Facebook page, we got a link right there for you.
Thank you very much.
Just go to the Rates and Lanes.
Wonderful.
Yes, sir. You can go to Racing Lanes with Rico Muhammad. You'll see the link. It'll take you directly to the TransComply UFSTP portion of the site where you can sign up, and they'll take care of you right over there.
Thank you so much, you guys. I really appreciate it. Rock on, man.
Sure. Thank you.
Bye.
Quick question, Hank. About the with the food safety program and everything. Now, is this primarily just going to be affecting reefers, or will this carry along the entire food chain as far as, you know, because you got further down where they're probably at the beginning of the line, you got some dry bulk type trailers and hopper bottoms that carry food stuff, probably that actually ends up in the food supply. Are they going to be under the same type of scrutiny or not?
Yeah, absolutely. There are provisions in terms of for extra clean-out procedures and things such as that for your dry food stuff, you know, your corn and items like that, your vegetable oil. So, yes, indeed, bulk tankers are involved as well.
Okay. Okay, well, that's good to know. So now, if you got any more questions, don't be bashful. We got a bunch of callers on the line. Like I said, we want to try to make this hour as caller-centric as possible to take advantage of Mr. Hank Seaton, you know, take advantage of his knowledge that he brings to the table. So if you guys got questions about contracts, lease purchases, leases, any type of contracts, rate confirmation, detention, any of that stuff, you can go ahead and press number one. We'll get your call screen. We'll bring you right up and on board. Right now we got a bunch of, but like I said, we got a bunch of people on the line, but we ran through the call bank that we've had. So if you got a question, now's the perfect opportunity for you to get in, and we'll get you right up and on board where you can talk to Hank and ask your question. Some other things that have been coming down the pike, Hank, I know that you discussed it in your last book, and I got to make sure I got to get my copy of the Rules of the Road. I got to get my own copy. But just real quickly, can we touch on, while we're waiting to get a couple of callers screened in, touch on leases and lease purchases, some things that we may need to be aware of when we're looking at those contracts?
Sure. A large number of carriers have traditionally provided equipment to independent contractors, which the contractors would turn around and lease back to the carrier. It's either owned by the carrier or the carrier affiliate. It creates some of that is, I think, very helpful because a lot of motor carriers will have good used equipment that makes excellent entrepreneurial opportunity for an owner-operator. The important things to be looking for in those agreements is the reputation of the carrier, whether or not you're getting skin in the game. By that, I mean, are you going to be able to work the truck down so that you'll get title to it when it's still got plenty of juice looked in it? If you got one of those lease agreements that basically you pay every month and what you pay is just an expense, and then you're a driver after you get the expense out of the way, it may not be nearly as attractive an issue. What I see most frequently with independent contractors is they're insufficiently capitalized, and they have a maintenance problem that's crippling. The other thing is the independent contractor model, which I'm four square in support of, is under really great attack in certain states. There are a spate of lawsuits being brought as alleged class actions, but actually, if you scratch it very hard, you'll see the Teamsters or somebody's behind it. The purpose of which is to say that actually independent contractors or owner-operators are not independent contractors. They should be treated as employees to get the benefits of the social welfare system. These lawsuits try to make the motor carrier look like the nasty captain of industry who is forcing independent contractors into bad deals. It's unfortunate, but those lawsuits are gaining some real cogency in states like California and Illinois and New Jersey, leading to some really strange outcomes that I think at some point the people who really believe in the independent contractor model and who are owner-operators need to say, hey, look, we don't want to be an employee. We want to be able to be an entrepreneur, and we're willing to take the risk involved in it because the gain outweighs the risk. And, you know, this is more of a philosophical issue, I guess, than anything else. The way the lawsuits tend to be going and the way the state laws tend to be going, we really got a real reversal. I think the current administration is much more favorable to the independent contractor model than the previous one, but I don't know how long it'll take the courts and the plaintiff's bar to understand that. I'd be interested in a dialogue with folks that are listening. You always get disgruntled contractors that haven't been treated right. But I think the vast majority of the people who've been in it for a long time are probably very happy with taking the tax breaks that come with being an independent contractor and not an employee. But this is a great sleeper argument that is floating just below the surface. In California and its treatment of overtime and meal breaks is just probably scratching the head of the problem.
Yes, sir. All right, we're going to jump back into the callers. We got a caller calling in from the 773 area code. He wants to get in and ask us a question. Caller, you're up live with Rico and Hank. How can we help?
Yes, hi. How you doing? And thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you for the call. What's your name, caller?
Yes. My name is John.
John. All right, John.
And I have a question about the... Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it, too. And I have a question about the claim that I actually have right now. It was a load of blackberries. And they refused the load because they said they were too cold. And my question is, can they really refuse that load because it's too cold?
The fact of the matter is that increasingly shippers, particularly on produce, are rejecting loads either because they're too hot or they're too cold. If you go into the red book and the blue book, you'll see that there are temperature variances for various produce. I think they'll say, and Rico's probably a better expert at this than I am, that if you freeze blackberries or blueberries, they're off color. You may not see the deterioration immediately, but if they're out of temperature around, they are certainly off grade or damaged. Some of that gets into, and FSMA will help you with that, I think. In the back, they just said, well, these berries are too cold, dump them. FSMA is going to say that your reefer is going to have to be able to download the temperature that was maintained during transit. So it may very well be that you can live and die by your reefer by showing the ambient temperature of the reefer during transit. I do know that freezing berries can be a real issue. I would say that the berries need to be inspected, not just some shipper saying, well, gee, they're too cold. Lots of times you'll get a situation in which the temperature contamination is a result of a block chute or other things, so it may not be that all of the berries are frozen. But if you pop in there and the berries are frozen, I think the shipper certainly is right to flag it. You should have temperature maintenance given to you at the time of pickup. Were you really out of temperature around during transit? Do you have a reefer malfunction?
No, actually not. Everything was fine. The temperature was fine, and the temperature was actually... The coldest, they take a sample of the temperature. The coldest was like 31.6. And I looked up on the internet, and they said that the freezing point for blackberries is actually 30.5. And the broker told me to just drop it at the cold storage, and they actually redelivered them to the same place, but for a different price. And now they want the price difference that I will pay. And it was actually two drops. The first one was okay. There was nothing wrong. It was the second one that they refused it.
Yeah, that may be part of a block shoot thing. But the other question that I've got for you is, under the new FSMA rules, and we don't have this in place yet, but the rule says that if the load could have been become adulterated or is to be rejected, it can't be put back in the food chain until it is inspected. Previously, we have had some rather arrogant people in the produce industry that said, no, the temperature is not good, we're not buying it, and then you go through this thing about, well, maybe the broker can sell it back to them for a reduced price, but nobody's ever really inspected and determined whether or not the product has lost its value. As part of what we talked about earlier, we're trying to work to set up people who can actually inspect this kind of product before it's just reconciled to breaking the claim over the butt of the driver. It's been a problem for me for the past 30 years that there's just a haphazard way in which claims are handled, and it sounds like you may have gotten caught up in that.
Yeah, the thing is that the insurance will not cover it. I'm sorry, the insurance will not cover because there was no reefer breakdown.
Yeah.
So am I really responsible for that? Or?
Yeah, listen, go ahead, Rico.
Well, the question that I was going to ask, and maybe it's just because it's my insurance carrier, I've had pretty good luck. I've never had a load rejected or damaged or anything like that, but my insurance carrier has always told me that if I have any of those issues or anything like that, to give them a call immediately and let them get involved to help and assist on situations like that. What's your advice on that, Hank? How do you think? How should we?
Well,
my advice
is you call up your insurance company and ask them how many more carriers they're willing to insure, because I find just the opposite. I find typically that the insurance underwriter is going to be passive, dodge the claim, and then send in the notice to the shipper that says, we're denying this because there's no reefer breakdown and we have no obligation to defend the poor carrier. If the broker's got the money, he deducts it from the carrier. If not, the carrier gets sued. Because I would say, in my experience, that with the exception of two or three insurance companies, most of them have only reefer breakdown. And typically, you have got to prove that there was a reefer malfunction to get coverage. Now, there are some insurance companies that do a great job, but being a lawyer, all I see is the time when the client calls me and says, I can't get the damn insurance company to do a thing.
Mm. That's unfortunate. That's very unfortunate. Okay, well, we definitely, you got anything else you want to add real quickly there, John?
It was, the load was, it was like 640 cases. And it was inspected, and under inspection, they wrote it not well colored. Does that mean anything, or what does that mean, not well colored?
Well, I would assume, and again, I'm not a BlackBerry expert, but I'm assuming that the coloration is evidence of frost or it's been frozen or thawed, that well-colored BlackBerry is one that, hasn't been, it's been maintained at proper temperature. You're thinking about the housewife, she's going through here and she's looking for bright BlackBerries, and if she sees a coloration problem with them, she's going to say, hey, that's a diminished value. And whoever is distributing the BlackBerries is going to say, well, we rejected this at the dock because if we went into Publix with these, they would say, get them out of our face. They don't have any shelf life. It's kind of like you know, bananas. Bananas get bruised, and if bananas get frozen, it takes a couple of days for it to show up. So I'm not an expert on that. I do know that as between regulated commodities and produce, the produce seems to be a whole lot more commodity specific. And I've told people with respect to these FSMA rules, we're not publishing rules on you know, how to deal with banana gas or whether you've got to check for tarantulas. There's just too many commodities to try to come up with a simple protocol that addresses how you handle you know, blackberries on the one instance or lettuce on the other. That seems to be an area of y'all's industry that has fared along pretty well. We really have very few instances of transportation adulteration that causes sickness. So I think a lot of people figure that some of this emphasis the government's putting on these new rules is really unnecessary.
All right, John, well, we appreciate the phone call. We're getting close to that time. Let's go to Brian. Brian, you are up on live with Rico and Hank. How can we help? What's your question?
Hey, good evening, gentlemen. I just had a quick question for y'all. If you go to a warehouse to make a delivery and they tell you, go ahead, disconnect your truck and pull on the other side of the block over there, do they assume full responsibility for the trailer and the contents if there's additional stops, or are you still liable?
You've got a great question. First of all, a lot of consignees take the position that they're not responsible for the count, even though you have backed into the dock and aren't allowed on the dock to watch the unloading. We've had cases in which people have been told to back that load of cigarettes into the dock and bobtail around somewhere else, and they'll never know when they're unloaded, only to have the whole load of cigarettes stolen off of the consignee's dock and had him make the claim. So it is a real question of chain of custody, particularly when you're not allowed on the dock to observe the unloading. If you're not allowed on the dock to observe the unloading and the guy is only unloading what's supposed to be three skids on the tail, you don't know whether he's taking the additional skid or not. You know, sometimes warehouses make up their shortage on the back of an empty trailer. That creates a real problem, both at time of loading, at time of unloading. How can you be responsible for the count on a shipment that you don't count on and you don't count off? Now, particularly when you've got a split load, you can't just say, well, my seal was intact, because the seal was broken at the first loading opportunity. Whether you need to protect yourself by opening the dock and taking pictures of how many skids are in there before you pull away, and then take a picture, you know, when you leave. If it's on pallets, I guess you can count the number of pallets that are there to be sure you haven't been ripped off. But that is a problem that you know, we have encountered. And the answer to part of that is to put shipper load and count on anything that you aren't allowed to count on.
Well, most of them don't allow. What if, you know, it's a refrigerated load and it trips those sensors because they sit there forever to break down the product and all that, and then you get somewhere and you know that you didn't have an issue, but you can't watch your temperature of your trailer because they have you on the other side of the block, like Walmart or AWG, for instance. How do you you know, protect yourself. Tell them I'm not disconnecting.
No, I don't think that's necessarily a plausible answer. I will tell you this: with these FSMA requirements and the downloadable reefer, I think you ought to be able to, after the fact, do a whole lot better job defending yourself. I mean, if you can show that you pulled in and the ambient temperature was 34, it had been maintained in transit, and they opened up the dock and the doors in the hot Memphis sun, and then claimed that the back two skids were temperature damaged. I think the combination of the reefer and the timing of it could point a finger at them, where traditionally people without the downloadable reefer haven't been able to effectively use that as a defense. You know, if you're loaded hot and you pre-cooled your load, and you get down the road and all of a sudden you see that the temperature is going up, then chances are you didn't get a chance to pulp it, and you can say there's an inherent vice issue as a defense. That is at the time when our industry really needs experts who understand what's called the law of thermodynamics, because a reefer really isn't going to bring down the temperature very far on a 500-mile haul, nor is it going to raise it very much. And when you get these odd-off situations, you know, your reefer records may be your best friends. If somebody will listen to you now, that's not to say that the broker is not going to say, to hell with you, I'm going to deduct. But as a legal issue, I think you've got more defenses, and certainly when the product gets more expensive, you know, the larger carriers are fighting those claims, when sometimes the little guys just get the famous deduct.
So you're saying on a multiple load, basically get that reefer download with the times on it showing it was at their dock in their possession. That's why the temperature changed, and it wasn't because of the reefer itself.
Yes. I mean, you know, I have had cases like a truckload of guacamole that was they claim was contaminated, and we use the reefer as proof that, look, you can see right here it was maintained in perfect temperature until you opened it up on the dock. And, you know, under a strict CARMAC analysis, if you receive it in good condition and deliver it damaged, you're responsible. But in produce, very frequently, which isn't covered by CARMAC, you can say, hey, look, you got to prove negligence, and we proved that based upon this reefer that we maintained it in transit at the temperature you required. So it must have been hot at loading, or it must have been left out in the Memphis sun. And then, you know, if you've got a contemporary record of where the shipment moved and what the ambient temperature was, that only further aids your analysis.
All right, great. I appreciate your help. And by the way, hello, Rico, and thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir, Brian. We appreciate you for calling. And that pretty much will wrap up the hour, Hank, real quickly. If people want to get in contact with you, if they need your assistance or your services, how can they do that?
Well, our website is called transportationlaw.net. That's probably the easiest way to remember it, transportationlaw.net. You can get our email and our phone numbers there. You know, otherwise, I think, Rico, you've probably got contact information up on your website, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank everyone for tuning in tonight. We'll see you the same time, same place next week. Thank everyone for helping out, participating. God bless you and good night.
Good night.
Hey, good night, Hank. I'm going to send you that email here in a few seconds.